Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast for February 27th, 2013. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. Folks, you're here on a very, very special day. This week on the podcast, because you requested it, we are going to be talking about how to conquer our fear, how to conquer the doubts that we have in terms of moving forward or challenging ourselves or trying to do the things that either we feel we can't do or we doubt that we can ever accomplish. And what I want to do today is really talk about a very special discussion that I had in one of my sessions, and this individual gave me full permission to talk about it, but it really is a beautiful example of how we can get wrapped up in anxiety when we're talking about the things that we fear. So we're going to be talking about fear and doubt in ways that you can begin to conquer it. Really, you really can. So I hope that I can share that with you in a way that inspires you and moves you to challenge some of those doubts that you have. In health news, gosh, a busy, busy week, and really an interesting week as it relates to chronic pain in the mind. This mind-body connection between pain and our emotions. We'll be talking about how stress reduction, and would you believe it, of all things, the size of our brains matters when we are trying to deal with chronic pain. And the latest updates on how stress itself, a fascinating study that came out of the University of Cambridge, on how stress itself causes physical pain. So you're going to want to stick around for that in the second half of the podcast. I've got some great headlines. I mean, whoa, we've got ourselves a fantastic podcast. I'm so happy that you are here. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Thank you so much for signing up for the newsletter. You can do that if you haven't already, right there on the homepage. And any questions, just email me. This podcast is happening because of a listener email saying, hey, Dr. Z, how about talking a little bit more about ways that we can conquer our fear? So, are you ready? Let's begin. Okay, so I'm in session last week, and really, the individual that I'm talking about said, if you want, go ahead and even use my name, but I'm not going to do that, but I'll call him Mark. But I have been seeing Mark for a long, long period of time, just a very, very charming man, one of my favorite people that I see, both for med management, but really the mainstay is our psychotherapy. And he's coming to the end of his career. He's a college professor. And one of the main things that he had always struggled with was being this kid who came out of a very, very small rural town and was able, one, to get his education, and two, really make a name for himself, both as an academic and a scientist. All through his life, his career, he suffered with this fear of having to prove himself. He was always just that kid from the small town. And we've worked on that over the years, and it's really been wonderful to see how Mark progressed over the years. But he came in last week, and I thought that this particular discussion that we had really talks to how fear can get spiraled up in our minds to where it really makes us doubt and challenge our abilities. But as I'll show you, some of the fear doesn't even need to be based in actual fact for it to affect us. So we were talking, and as I said, he's finishing up with his career, and he's going to be retiring. And he told me about a European vacation that he's planning with his family. Oh, wow, that's great. And he was telling me how he's going to be going to Germany, and then they're going to go to Poland, and they're even going to make it to Italy. But then he stopped and he said, you know, I'm getting pretty anxious about it, and I hope that I can do it. And I said, well, what do you mean? Why wouldn't you be able to do it? Well, he said, you know, I can fly anywhere around the country, kind of domestic travel, but this is a really long trip. I said, yeah, it's kind of long. I said, well, here's the thing. I really get nervous on a plane, especially long distances. And I said, what's going on? Why do you think that you're so nervous? And he said, well, I don't like being in tight spaces. I get nervous and I kind of have this fear of throwing up. And I said, well, okay. He hadn't really told me about this before. You could have sworn he did, but I don't remember him telling me about this. I said, well, tell me a little bit about this. And he said, well, I've always kind of had it, and it just makes me worried. Can I go? Is this going to be too long of a trip? What if I throw up? So, you know, we kind of explored this a little bit, and I said, well, tell me about where this fear came from. So he starts talking, and he said, it goes back to middle school. The middle school. And he said he had a good friend of his, one of his best friends, and they were pretty active. They were athletes, and they ran track. And one of his friends, in a different period of the day, was running track. And Mark had heard later that when he finished doing his track, his running, he had stopped, gotten quite sick, and had vomited, and literally passed out and died. And what he had heard was that his friend had aspirated on his vomit, literally choked to death right there on the track. He was devastated. He could not believe it. Here, it's a friend of his, that age, nothing's supposed to happen to us, and he had lost his friend. Now, he was terrified by this, and he can remember that feeling. He said, I always associated throwing up with dying. And I can really feel it right now as I'm thinking about going to Europe, even though I'm going to be with my family, and it's going to be one of the best vacations of our lives. Now, we talked about it a bit, but here is the amazing part. He goes on and he says, well, I need to tell you something else. In high school, a few years later, I found out what happened to my friend. It turns out that his family had heart problems. And a lot of his family had this genetic defect in the heart, and many of his family members died a premature death. And it turns out what happened was that when he finished running, yes, he did throw up, but he had an arrhythmia that ended up giving him a heart attack right there. A tragic, tragic story, tragic story. But his friend didn't die from throwing up. He told me he did throw up after he was running because he was exerting himself, but it was later, a few minutes later, after that was done, that a heart attack had befallen his friend. Tragic story, but the important part here is Mark realized that from an early age, a few years after that in high school, that his friend didn't die from choking on his vomit, but it had been such a traumatic description back a few years prior that that connection stuck. And not only did it stick, it continues to this day. And he says, you know, on a logical basis, I get that. I know that that isn't why my friend passed away, but I can't get that out of my head. the fact that throwing up could be associated with death, and I've always worried about it. Now, we talked about it, and he went on to an incredible experience he had about a year prior when he was in a group therapy type of session. And he said one of the other members in the group out of nowhere says, you know, I always had this fear of vomiting, and it stopped him cold. He said, I just couldn't believe it. And I thought, well, what couldn't you believe? He said, well, I thought I was the only person. I thought I was the only person in the world that suffered with a fear of vomiting. And we have a good relationship. So I said, well, exactly, who the heck are you? Who the heck are you that you're the only person out of 7 billion people that is going to be afraid of vomiting? And he kind of chuckled. He hadn't really thought about it in that way. But I thought there were so many important lessons here. So many important lessons on fear that we all carry with us. And there's so much that we can learn from Mark's experience, and why I asked him if it was okay to talk about this a little bit on my podcast. Now, we don't all have those extreme types of fears, but there's no doubt that a lot of the fear that comes up for us, things that we're worried about that we don't feel that we can do, success that either we can't see in our minds doing or absolutely do not believe that we can achieve because we're afraid of failure or we're afraid of success or we just don't know that we can do it because we'll embarrass ourselves in front of our friends or our colleagues or our family. But yet, he continued to persevere. Now, to get back to the discussion we were having about this trip to Europe, I said, okay, I get that, the fear of throwing up. But what else is going on? Why are you so worried about this trip? I said, well, such a long distance. There's so many moving parts to it. I guess I worry about what would happen if we miss a flight or we get delayed, or what happens if I get the wrong exchange rate as we're moving through countries. Those were the kind of things he was worrying about. And because I've known him for the longest time, I said, all right, Mark, let me understand this. You are worried about vomiting because you're worried you'll die. And you base that on what had happened to you in middle school about a friend who tragically passed away, which you thought had to do because he threw up, but really wasn't. It was actually a fatal heart attack. Very tragic, but fatal heart attack. And now you're worried about what that would mean to you if you happened to throw up. Never mind that every seat has a bag in case you get sick. You're also worried about missing a flight or getting delayed, which happens even in Europe and in America, and you would easily get shifted to the next flight. Or you're worried about an exchange rate that you might overpay for a souvenir, a dinner, a soda, a glass of wine. And he kind of laughed. He laughed. He looked at it and realized the absurdity of it. And he realized at that moment where his mind spiraled him up. And I think that all of us can relate to this to some degree. It doesn't have to be about a trip, but we've talked about the overpowering sense that our negative thoughts, our automatic thoughts, can take over in our mind and begin, if we're not careful, to dictate how we act. The doubts that we have, the fears that we have, the anxieties that we hold on to, if we're not careful to keep them in check, well, they will dominate us. They will get in the way of everything that we want to achieve. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't. And I'm not saying that in a patronizing way. It doesn't have to be that way, and you can begin to conquer them. You're already doing it, and I'll show you why. But there are things that we can do to keep those anxieties and worries in check. Now, in Mark's case, as we had talked about it in the past, one thing that he found was really helpful for him was that he always wrote the things that he had to do down so that they didn't get away from him. He didn't forget them, or he didn't get overwhelmed and start to worry about the things he couldn't remember that he had to do. I think we've all been there. So he would write them down on a huge blackboard, a chalkboard, And he would say, at least I know that everything is there. I don't have to think about it in my head. I can worry about it, but it's up there on the chalkboard. Pretty good technique, if you ask me. And we've talked about that here on The Healthy Mind, particularly when we start to get very anxious about all the things that we have to do, everything that's in front of us, the tasks, the worries, the bills, and everything. And one of the most powerful things to do is to write it down, the power of writing to help calm us. Now, in this case with Mark, I told him, write down all your anxieties. Write down everything that you're worried about happening on this European vacation and take a look at it. How much of it, one, will happen, two, is accurate, and three, is even realistic? And he really felt comfortable with that. He could see kind of a light bulb going on in his mind, because he had used that technique already just to make sure that he was getting things done. And I really feel that writing and being able to take all those worries and concerns that we have and challenge them to see how accurate they are really can be very powerful. These automatic thoughts can dominate us. And we have these thoughts because of our anxiety, of our worries, of our insecurities. But ladies and gentlemen, we all have them. We all have these fears and doubts. And the trick is, at least in those that don't let it dominate them, is to challenge them. Now, I've said you've already been conquering your fear and doubt. And what I tell people all the time, and we've said it here on The Healthy Mind, is look at the success in your life already and use that as the basis for the strength that you already have and why you can overcome some of these doubts that you have. Your careers, your relationships, the successes that you have had, those are because of you and your strengths. It's a lot easier to remember the negative. And we've talked about the evolutionary basis for that, right? The negative thoughts are important to have because oftentimes they're a signal of danger, and that means our survival. So of course, negative thoughts are going to be more powerful and we'll react to them than the positive ones. But that's why we've got to do the work to build up those positive thoughts in an authentic way, in a genuine way. You can't just motivate yourself with just repeating positive thoughts that don't ring true. But I ask you to look inside your life and look at the success that you've already accomplished and use that as the basis and motivation for moving you forward. If it's something that you don't feel you can do, look at the times in your life where you've pushed through that fear and you have been able to accomplish it. We see that all the time, at least in my line of work, with regards to chronic pain and these fears. People who are dominated by the physical pain that is in their lives or are very fearful of moving or walking or doing things because they're going to aggravate the pain. And it is only when they let that go and realize that pain is just pain, it's not going to hurt them any further, that their pain begins to subside because they take control. They start to become active. They start to do things again. And the anxiety and the worry that's driving that pain just goes away, or it greatly reduces and people have their lives back. Anxiety can do that to us. The spiral can move very, very quickly. And it, along the way, picks up every insecurity we've had as the reason why we can't do these things. But we continue to persevere. You do. No matter what it is, you're continuing to persevere. You're showing up. We all are. That takes strength. And you have to take that and realize how powerful that is. If you take the time to look in whatever way works for you, talking to yourself, meditating on it, journaling it, talking to a friend, talking to a therapist, but taking those thoughts, those automatic negative thoughts, and putting them out there on notice to challenge them. A lot of times, if not all of the time, what we fear happening never happens. Or it never happens to the level of worry that we have about what the outcome will be. It never does. It's never as bad as we think. But yet we continue to think that. So by putting in some of that energy, confronting those thoughts, saying, wait a minute, you're not just going to run amok in my mind. I am going to challenge you. You will see yourself becoming empowered, and you'll see your anxiety start to decrease, and your worry and your fear. And what that will be replaced by is action. And action brings more success, and success brings confidence, and confidence pushes you further to do more things to become the person that you want to be. You can do it. You are that powerful. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. You can do it just by taking it step by step. The fear is real. The anxiety is real. But it's in all of us. And all of us have the power to rise above it. And you will too. You'll see it. And when you do, oh, look out, because that, my friends, is an incredible step to take as we walk down our road to the healthy mind. And now it's time for news. Okay, well, a busy week, especially as it relates to the mind-body phenomenon of stress and pain. And that's where I wanted to focus on these two headlines today. The first story, the headline, "Can Stress Cause Physical Pain? New Clues Emerge." And this was a study that came out of the University of Cambridge and also University College of London. And it looked at these mind-body disorders, what they call psychogenic disease, what we've talked about on the program as psychophysiologic disorders. But they found, the researchers did, that people who suffer from the stress-related pain had brains that function differently. And they were able to show that by various tests that they did on these individuals. But in general, the psychogenic diseases, and that just means illnesses that come from emotional or mental stress, can look exactly like illnesses that are caused by damage to the nerve, damage to the brain, damage to our muscles, physical pain, and other symptoms as well. I mean, there can be paralysis as well. But what these researchers looked at were people that were suffering with dystonias, and that's painful muscle contractions that occurred in their legs. And what the study involved were people who were having true, what they call organic pain and cramping in their legs, these dystonias, psychogenic, where they couldn't find any reason as to why these people would be having these symptoms, and then healthy controls. And what they wanted to do was take a look at all aspects of their condition, including being able to visualize what's going on in the brain and see if there's any differences that are going on. So what specifically did they do? They performed these PET brain scans that take a look at the activity in the brain. They measured blood flow and brain activity of all of the groups. And they also looked at the electrical activity of the muscles in the leg to see what differences might be there, if they were there. And the results were pretty interesting. They found that the brain function of individuals with these psychologically manifested pain illnesses were not the same as the healthy individuals. And that kind of makes sense. I mean, even if it's psychologically mediated, you'd expect there to be differences in what the brain looks like. Now, the changes, though, were very different from the brains of the individuals that had the organic disease, those that were diagnosed with it, and the way that they did it was through genetic testing. Now, the findings, the brain results, were surprising even to the researchers. Dr. James Rowe from the University of Cambridge said, quote, "What struck me was just how very different the abnormal brain function was in patients with the genetic and the psychogenic dystonia. Even more striking was that the differences were there all the time, whether the patients were resting or trying to move their legs," end of quotes. Now, in the past, what has been thought in these psychological diseases or psychogenic diseases was that an abnormality of the frontal part of the brain, the front part of the brain, what they called the prefrontal cortex, was previously thought to be hallmark for this type of disease, a psychologically mediated disease. But what they found was that this finding was not unique to it. And they found this activity present in the patients with the genetic cause, at least of this leg cramping, as well. Now, according to another researcher, Dr. Annette Schrag, psychogenic illness, the psychologically mediated physical symptoms, are quite common. According to her, quote, 1 in 6 patients that sees a neurologist has a psychogenic illness. They are as ill as someone with organic disease, but with a different cause and a different treatment need. End of quotes. And they hope that some of these studies adds to the understanding of how our mind can turn our emotions into physical symptoms. And that's something here at The Healthy Mind we are going to continue to talk about. And whenever a study of this type comes up, you are going to be the first to know about it. Now, the next piece of news, and this goes along the line of the mind-body syndrome as well. The headline, Why Stress Reduction and Brain Size May Be the Key to Managing Chronic Pain. Chronic pain, we know it's an epidemic worldwide. It's about 100 million people. Can you believe that? 100 million people in America suffer with chronic pain. Across the globe, it's estimated 1.5 billion people are feeling the effect of chronic pain. And really, for those that suffer with it, it's as much an emotionally exhausting illness as it is a physical process. We know that stress has long been linked to chronic pain, and we've talked about that here for a long, long time. But according to a new study from the University of Montreal, stress reduction may be the key to managing chronic pain. Now, what's interesting is it's particularly important for people that have a smaller than average sized hippocampus. Now, what's a hippocampus? It's a part of the brain that's responsible for our memory. It turns out that these individuals, those that may have a smaller than average hippocampus, are particularly vulnerable to stress. And when they do the stress reduction techniques, they start to feel better. But why does this happen, or how does it happen? Well, it has to do, not too surprisingly, with the stress hormone, cortisol. And we've talked about that before, how that gets released. It's a hormone that really is the stress hormone. When we are activated, when we are stressed, we release cortisol. And that begins a whole cascade of processes that changes the biology in our body to be ready for stress. And what they found was that when cortisol is released to stress, and you happen to have a small hippocampus, this can lead to an increased vulnerability and pain, and it could increase the risk of that pain going and becoming chronic in nature. Now, I have to say, it's a fairly small study, about 34 patients, but what they looked at was those that are suffering with chronic back pain and those that didn't have any pain at all. And they looked at their cortisol levels. They looked at the self-perception of pain and the way that they assessed it. They looked at the size of the hippocampus, and they also looked at the activity in the brain with MRI functioning. And what they found was that patients with chronic pain generally had higher levels of cortisol than those that were healthy. And, as I had said, patients with a smaller sized hippocampus, that memory center of the brain, have higher cortisol levels, and they have stronger responses to acute pain in a region of the brain that's involved in the anticipatory anxiety in feeling pain. So as the researcher said, what this means is that there is a greater chance of chronic pain vulnerability. Why? You've got a smaller hippocampus, you get a stronger stress response, which will increase the level of pain that you feel, and because you feel more intense pain, there's a greater chance of that becoming chronic. So what they had said was it is of urgent nature that people begin stress management techniques, because if we can relax ourselves, ease ourselves down from that anxiety, there's less of a chance that the pain will be that intense. And because of that, a less chance that it will become chronic. The mind-body connection, both in the way that our emotions can lead to physical symptoms, but also physical symptoms themselves can be managed by controlling our emotions. Some really interesting studies this week in health news. Okay, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. Pessimism about the future may lead to a longer and healthier life. Older people who have low expectations for a satisfying future may be more likely to live longer, healthier lives than those who see brighter days ahead. A surprising new study from research published by the American Psychological Association. The next headline. Persistent negative attitudes can undo effectiveness of exposure therapy for phobias. This is out of Ohio State University. Because confronting fear won't always make it go away, researchers suggest that people with fears and phobias must change their negative attitudes about feared objects or events to achieve a more long-lasting recovery from what scares them the most. Those pesky automatic negative thoughts. And finally, this is great news for thehealthymind.com. The headline, self-help books and websites can benefit severely depressed patients. People with severe depression show at least as good clinical benefit from low-intensity interventions like self-help books and websites as less severely ill patients, according to a brand new study published in BMJ. Wow. You hear that? TheHealthyMind.com is good for your health. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have done it again, you and I. We have made it to the end of yet another broadcast of The Healthy Mind. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Please don't hesitate to sign up for the free monthly newsletter. You can find the tab right there on the homepage. Follow me anytime on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Zafiridis. And any questions, comments, anything that you want to talk about, I want to hear from you. Don't hesitate to email me. The email address, peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on The Healthy Mind.